Okay.
Okay, so ladies and gjentlemen, welcome back to another episode of In the Eyes of Truth. Back with us is Pascal Lota, and for those who don't know, Pascal is in Japan. You should know by now because you should have signed up for neutrality studies.
Thank you, Stas. Yes, everybody, you should.
You should.
Hello, dear friends. Just want to remind you, if you like this video or you like what you hear, click like, subscribe if you haven't subscribed yet. Send it to your friends. Let's grow this channel. Maybe we can finally hit it up to 100,000. That'd be a good round number for the summer. So let me know, leave some comments, and give a thumbs up. So look forward to seeing you in the next video. Cheers.
Right then. Where does one relocate properly? Desert? 40 degrees? No water? Forests? Rivers? Four seasons? Desert? 40 degrees? No water? Forests? Rivers? Four seasons?
It's actually much simpler than most people think.
Good Lord, that's less paperwork than a gym membership.
As a British man, I chose the place where I can still complain about the weather properly.
All right, let's head that way. Sounds good, I'm ready.
Move to Russia. Start a new life. It's easier with Moscow Connect. Website for details, moscowconnect.ru.
Good. Pascal, let's talk about Trump's visit to China. Which was obviously pretty much a failure. And what kind of effect it's having on East Asia, Japan, Korea, or South Korea. North Korea is probably thrilled. So
well, you know, it was quite interesting. I had at least three talks over the last couple of days on my channel as well about that. The number one thing to take away is that it was just kind of a business trip plus tourist moment when some of the richest people of the United States, including the richest person on earth, Elon Musk, basically had a free trip to Beijing and could take like pictures. And even Marco Rubio was like kind of admiring the ceiling in, I think, the Great Hall of the People. And you know, it was a lovely trip. It was like a school excursion, and it was planned as one, and then it happened as one. And when I say planned, it's like it was not really planned. I mean, that's one of the things that we learned. I mean, there were no Sherpas, there was no big diplomatic kind of, you know, preparation, da da da. It was just done very, very briefly, very quickly. And the Chinese are, of course, highly pragmatic people. They just went along with that, announced it, and then they did it perfectly. And kind of Xi Jinping gave Donald Trump all of the honors, but the regular spiel, right, including the red carpet. But the second he was on the airplane, red carpet was like gone within 30 seconds. I mean, they were very efficient about it.
Did they burn it?
And in a sense, you know, it was just a lovely little meeting, and the Chinese didn't really give anything, nor did they kind of really help with anything. Like Donald Trump apparently wanted some help with opening the Strait of Hormuz, but the Chinese just said like, oh, you know, we are for freedom of for free passage in the high seas, and we're for international law and so on. That was a very smart thing. They said several times, you know, international law should be followed, also in the situation in West Asia, which is a very nice way of saying that, you know, Donald, you United States, you should stop the war because it's a war of aggression against international law. You should pay reparations because that's what you have to do under international law. You must stop the blockade because that's not part of what international law says, and so on and so forth. So they found many well polite ways of actually telling the United States that, look, this is what you did and you should stop it. And the Chinese on their side, interestingly, they were just polite about it. They were just they are under no illusions that with this administration you can make any kind of deal that will stick. So they're not really trying, but at the same time they're not trying to piss off the Americans, right? So since this is the first time in 9 years that US head of state visits China, the last one was actually also Donald Trump back
in
2017.
Was it 9 years,
yeah.
really?
Yeah,
Wow.
There was I just had a talk today with Sheng Zhang from the Chinese Middle East specialist, West Asia specialist, and he also pointed it out. Look, it's been 9 years because Biden didn't visit. So the last visit was also Mr. Trump, and also already the last visit, you know, they had a good time. And then a year later, Trump comes out with a first kind of with a trade war on China, which surprised them because they thought they had kind of a working relationship with that administration, but that didn't work 9 years ago or 8 years ago. It's probably not going to work now, but they're still signaling, look, we can have an outcome among us, right? And Xi Jinping actually gave a speech about the two-cities trap, avoiding that. You know, they even tried to phrase things in a way that the American side could probably understand in the way that they're reasoning about it. But I mean, we will see where this leaves us. I guess from all the talks I had, most people are more or less happy that there was no huge fallout and that Donald Trump didn't declare the Third World War or whatnot. So that kind of he went back in a happy and a good mood, and that's good enough. Funnily enough. But the Chinese did the Chinese way. Actually, I think the Japanese tried to do the Japanese way back when Takaichi went to visit him about a month and a half ago. They just tried to keep Donald Trump happy. Of course, the Japanese had to do it from a much more subordinate and obedient position. Right. And you can see how they clearly use a different strategy. I mean, the Chinese used the strategy, be polite as an equal. The Japanese used the let's rub his ego as much as we can being in the position we're in. I don't want to say brown nose, but that's basically the idea. I mean, she really tried to rub it into his face that he's the greatest. I mean, she said, like, only you can bring peace to us, Donald, you're so great. But
Did she call him daddy?
No. You know, the Japanese
quite
have their
that
problem,
level.
But they're not that low. I mean,
a little self-respect was left.
A little bit of self-respect is left. Yeah, there are things even they didn't do. I mean, they laid flowers at the memorial for the Enola Gay and whatnot, which is bad enough. But in terms,
that's a humiliation, Rachel, right there.
Well, if you think about it in pragmatic terms, what you need from the United States is not to blow up all of the security architecture that you build your entire structure, your entire defense thinking, like the last 50 years is built around that thing, around that core. And what you need is the United States to not completely kill it before you have a replacement. And the Japanese are working now toward, you know, long-term planning to get to be less dependent on the US, but it needs time. And in the meantime, if you need to rub a bag or two, that's what you do. And in a sense, that's like a similar strategy to what I say with China, although China again is like doing it from the position of an equal and from much, much more strength. But it's like, let's not piss this dude off, right? So keep things stable, keep things the same. Or do not upset a personality who might, you know, with a tweet destroy large parts of your economy, right? So it's you handle a raw egg. It's like handling a raw egg, and I think both of them are trying to do that at the moment from their own different positions where they're coming from, and the Chinese from a much stronger position. But they could have been nasty. The Chinese They could have just like blamed the US. They could have lectured. They could have even just given made little attacks or whatnot, or proposed some form of US. You must de-escalate from the Middle East. They didn't.
But so, did they ever? I don't remember the Chinese ever being that like that. I mean, Americans.
Well, you know, they
the
are
Europeans
like
do they, that.
Nah, yeah, but when it comes, let's. How they approach the Philippines or how they approach smaller neighbors, you know, they do have a different diplomatic interactions, let's put it that way, or the way that they criticize others. They criticize the United States too, but they criticize it clearly as a peer, as an equal, and not as a somebody that should find their place in the larger system. And when you look at the way that China got really, really seriously angry with Japan back in December when Takaichi made these stupid comments about, you know, Taiwan being she used a very special phrase, and existence threatening situation. I forgot the exact term, but she used that one, and that one had also to do a lot with history. And in any way, she said basically they would use the Japanese military forces, the self-defense forces, to intervene in such a situation, and that didn't go down with China at all. And it's not just they got mad, they actually used serious threats. They even said, like, we should now consider activating one of the clauses in the UN. It's like, if we have a revisionist power, then all of us need to go to war with them again. Right, I mean, they went really, really, really far. And that
most
was
people
the
don't
Chinese...
know that clause exists, by the way. It exists for Germany, yeah. It exists for Italy.
It does. I mean, the UN at the end of the day is the club of the victors of the Second World War. It has become universalized and so on, but it is still, the core is the club of the victors, right? That explains also the five permanent powers, right? But
right.
Yeah, that one aside, in general, I would say we see how China is approaching the United States in a very specific way. The hopeful thing is that the Chinese seem not have given up on the idea that an outcome or some form of understanding, a rivalry, but not a war, is still very much possible. At the same time, they also, from the Russian experience and the Iranian experience, are under no illusions that the guy whom he was visiting, whom Xi Ji was welcoming in Beijing, might at any point in time in the future, if it serves him, like, sign a piece of paper that would allow droning of Xi and his entourage, right? A decapitation strike on the Chinese. I mean, that's just something the Americans now do. That's just part and parcel of the playbook. And this is well understood. But so what do? You got to work with what you've got. And the Chinese, they do so. And they still would like to nudge it in a way that doesn't lead to utter complete confrontation.
Which is amazing. Normally, the reason is, well, normally, historically, the reason the countries don't assassinate each other's leaders is because it always comes back that the other guy decides, okay, fine, two can play that game, let's go after you. You know, America is a prime example. You don't have to go after the president or even members of his administration to make a point. There are thousands of state senators, governors, mayors. This is the reason you don't do that, because you put a bullseye on every single government official in your government. And America is very easy to put a bullseye in that. But
presidents
don't seem to get that.
Yeah, but also let's look at the track record, right, of the last 250 years since the U.S. was founded. I mean, the only ones who actually kill U.S. Top politicians are other U.S. citizens. I mean, Lincoln, Kennedy, all the others, and also the top people. I mean, it's the United States, again, is still, like, geography matters, right? Fish to the east, fish to the west, Canada to the north, and Mexico to the south. It's like, you cannot be in a much more strategically advantageous position. It's just darn hard to seriously, like, through the implements of war, actually kill a top U.S. leader. And historically, in the last 250 years, I can't think of an example of an important U.S. leader who was killed by an outsider and not somebody from within the same kind of club.
Fully outsider or with help from outside?
Well, give me an example of an important U.S. leader, huh?
Kennedy.
The
Israelis.
I mean,
there's so much. So the documents have been leaking out. The Israelis have their fingerprints all over it. I'm not saying they did it by themselves. But the deep state with the Israelis. Kennedy was pissed off that the Israelis had stolen American nuclear blueprints and stolen American enriched uranium, and was demanding a full accountability of it.
So. Okay, let's take that. That's a possibility. We know that the bullet who killed him was fired by a U.S. citizen, right? We know that. I mean, the kill chain is quite long, and maybe you can find somebody within the kill chain who's from the outside, but a good part of it was implemented from the inside, right?
Oh,
so
yeah,
it's like,
absolutely.
Plus, I mean, the US Israeli thinking of them as two separate things is a little bit of thinking of your heart and your brain as two separate parts. You know, it's still the same body politic overall,
yes.
the collective West. So, you know, that's the only thing that really could threaten a leader. And they understand that in the US. They understand it, like, intuitively, right? Donald Trump, the only people who are dangerous to him and fired at him twice were not the Russians. It wasn't the Chinese. It was inside jobs, right? These lone gunmen who've been under CIA surveillance forever, but then they're suddenly lone gunmen because the CIA is so bad at pinpointing nut jobs that then hide out on rooftops and shoot at leaders.
Especially
out of
when
nowhere.
They encourage those nut jobs to go out there and suddenly scrub their online profiles.
Yeah,
but unfortunately, everything's on their internet for good.
Yeah, sure. And if you were Donald Trump, and if you're probably blackmailed by the Israelis with some Epstein stuff, which I anything but rule out, I actually kind of think that that's how they got him to the place where he is with Iran. Then you know the threat to these leaders is not that the outsider. It's like the what is baked into the political system itself. Yeah, so that's why I do think they also act with impunity. And the Israelis, too, they act with impunity, right? Because their experience, too, has been one of being very, very well protected against anyone doing the same thing. And the only one who's changing that thing at the moment is the Iranians. They kind of reestablished this kind of we pay you back in equal volumes. They were not able to kill Netanyahu yet. But they established a point. If you try to do that to us on a societal to our society, what you did to Gaza, well, we can do the same to you. Desalination plants, Dimona, and so on. And they kind of got the point across. Maybe not completely, but they're working on this, establishing this kind of reciprocity again.
You know, but the interesting thing in that is when you say that about the U.S. really hasn't been blatant to do this since, well, it only really started in the last about 15 years. Okay, what? if you going after world leaders like this. Even Saddam was arrested after he was overthrown when they found him. They could they didn't try to assassinate him during the lead up. They didn't try to take him out, and they could have. They prefer in Europe. They work through Operation Gladio. Yeah, they've killed European leaders, Western European leaders, keep them alive.
Yeah, I was about to say that they
but
did.
But they used European hands. Most of the time, done by the people in their own countries under CIA tutelage. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But they haven't been blatant like this.
Yeah. Maybe maybe this is just one of the other signs of the decay of the empire, right? At the height of your power, you do things overtly and people love you for it. You do it overtly, they love you for it. I mean, killing Hitler, Mussolini, and so on, or downstream, that's of course a good thing because everybody wanted them gone, right? You do it overtly, right. Everybody applauds. Then you do it covertly, so nobody knows, and you can keep up the scheme. And then you lose power, you lose it, and then you're forced to basically do it overtly, but this time they don't love you for it anymore.
Yeah.
And I mean, we've had all of these very suspicious deaths, including a UN General Secretary, Dag Hammarskjöld, right? We've had the way that they tried to assassinate Fidel Castro several times in Bay of Pigs
about
and whatnot.
100.
I mean, about 100. I mean, and of course, let's not forget South America. I mean, Mr. Allende and so on. I mean, they killed a lot of leaders before, but they tried to have plausible deniability and outsource it to the locals. And now they're losing their capacity. So the last thing that's left is try to do it yourself and stand with it. But it shows that you're losing the grip. I mean, you have no more internal Iranians to go and shoot the Ayatollah, right? So you've got to do it yourself.
And you're not doing it with assassins or anything like that that can give you any kind of deniability. You're doing it with a missile. You're doing it so blatantly at this point.
Yeah, plus you, of course, don't listen to them because they said a million times, you kill our leaders, we're fine with that. We build our system for that. And if you do it, you're just going to give us a new, you're just going to promote the younger ones with fresher ideas. And that's exactly what they did. And you give us a martyr. They gave the Iranians a martyr. I mean, he was like 80, what, 5?
I know.
And bad
he
health.
Wasn't long and, for the world to begin with.
And of course, they also killed the family and the grandchild and so on and a lot of people. But in a sense, the Iranians, I think that's probably the only thing that surprised him in his death, that it was done to him when he was with his family and everybody and not when he was like alone. But whatever. I mean, the whole strategy of the Iranians was then built around exactly that everybody's expendable and that they're willing to die. And bringing us back to the discussion, this is actually something that Sheng Tsang told me that the Chinese are very impressed by, that the Iranians are, the whole leadership is willing to die. And this is something that for them is is also difficult to comprehend because the Chinese work differently. But China now learned a great deal about Iran, and actually the image of Iran got quite lifted up quite significantly inside China, not in the general population, but also among the politicians who actually kind of expected Iran to lose this and to be gone very quickly, and who were very disappointed when Khomeini was killed so easily, because it seemed to be proof that Iran is badly prepared and weak. But turns out, no, it was part of the strategy. Not that Khomeini wanted to be killed, but his killability, his expendability is kind of baked into the system, and that then worked as a system to repel the Americans. That's changing now the attitude, because you remember at the beginning, China in the second week didn't veto that UN Security right. Council resolution that condemned Iran for unprovoked attacks against Gulf states. Question was why. Answer, China thought Iran was on the losing end and didn't really want to piss off its very important Gulf trading partners, because they have a good relationship and want to maintain that. So just let it be, and then maybe we can maintain the relationship with the Gulf. But now that that changed, it kind of leads to a reassessment about the entire region within also the factions inside the Chinese political system, because also they have factions, some that want to be closer to the Gulf, some that want to be closer to Iran for ideological reasons or whatnot. So, but it's leading now to a reassessment, definitely.
Yeah, it's had the same effect in Russia, because, you know, Russia's had this. On the one hand, you have the leadership in Russia. There's some leadership in Russia that would never sacrifice themselves for anything. On the other hand, there's the mentality, and you see it in the military officers, even if they know they're going into basically a suicidal mission for Christ and country. You know, that's the mentality. And it's always been a very strong mentality, because self-sacrifice and martyrdom in Orthodoxy is a very big thing. As they say, the church is built on the bones of martyrs, whether they're martyrs, pacifist martyrs, or martyrs that fell in battle. So that's actually sparked a lot of debate inside of Russia, too. It's like, because there's, I won't say everybody, but there's quite a few Russian leaders that go, you know, if I have to die for the country, I die for the country. And you saw that even in the Soviet Union, because there was a prime example that was... there's still excavations going on all over the more static fronts, pulling up bones. Every year they pull up Russian bones, German or others' bones. And a couple of years ago, they pulled up near St. Petersburg, they pulled up the remains of killed soldiers. A lot of these guys got buried when trenches would collapse, things like that. Yeah. Bunkers would get wiped out, and they just get buried in the muck. And one of them had the pin for a people's deputy, so he was basically a member of parliament. And we've had several members of parliament and several governors and others have quit their jobs and went to fight. And several have died. So this is the mentality. So, yeah, Iran's had that effect in Russia, too.
Yeah, and that mentality, you know, it actually kind of people perceive that. So what Cheng also told me this morning is that one more thing that a lot of Chinese are seeing is, you know, you have a lot of Iranian students in China, actually.
And in Russia, too.
In Russia, too. You know what? A lot of them actually went back when the war started. And I did an interview last week with one of the guys who does the Lego videos.
Mm-hmm. Oh, did you? Really?
Yeah, it's very
share interesting. Share the contacts. I want to talk to him.
The video is going to come out soon. I don't have his contact. It's like the contact of a contact, but really fascinating guy. And we had a translator. So in the end, we didn't need the translator very much because the guy could speak more than he thought himself, I guess, that he could. But then the translator was still present. And the translator was actually had finished his PhD 2-3 years and was like an assistant professor in Pakistan. Iranian assistant professor in Pakistan, teaching there for a year. And then when the war broke out, he quit and he said, I'm going to go back to Tehran, you know, first week of the war and everything. And so there is a lot of Iranians actually who took this as a call to action, even if they were not in the army or anything, but as in now is the time to go back and to support the country. And that is something that registers in China. That's something that apparently also registers in Russia. And it's not to say that that's going to win the war, but that gives you an important clue about how Iran as a society functions. And at the end of the day, these horrible wars, they actually bring out a little bit more clarity about societies. You know, we have all of these assumptions. Oh, you know, Iran is just a one more demonstration away from being overthrown and whatnot. And none of us was really sure what was happening, because we've also seen how Syria developed and how Syria collapsed overnight. So things can happen, but it seems that Iran is not anywhere close to a Syria moment. That's at least what it looks like from now. And that's what we've learned through like a lot of like warfare and death and destruction. But like what then societies come out of, that's kind of instructive, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It is. Like it or not, I mean, war brings around, obviously, very many horrible things, especially if it if you lose control over it and it goes to the extremes. But it also has a tendency to, as a forge on society. It can radically change society into something much more, I won't say uniform, but much more solidified.
Yeah, because, I mean, look at what happened to Vietnam, right? I mean, after the Americans lost, and, you know, I keep saying, like, America just didn't win, but South Vietnam lost and was then eradicated right. In 75, right? Fall of Saigon, South Vietnam gone. And people went to re-education camps and whatnot, or were sent there, and there was violence, and there were executions and whatnot. What came out of it in the end is the Vietnam that we know today, which is, of course, a much more cohesive society than it was during the Civil War, for obvious reasons. And so not saying that this is good or that it's bad, it's just what the end of war then does. It tends to create a new the cards are dealt again anew, and then people work with what they're left. And now it seems right. to me that Iran is probably working from a much stronger position than before, also internally, because they were able to take out a lot of like resistance places. And I'm not saying that's good, I'm not saying that's bad, I'm just saying that's most likely what is now the case within the way society works.
And I think a lot of people that were maybe pinning their hopes on the West in Iran got a dose of the West, starting with 158 killed little girls, plus 20-something teachers, that pretty much burnt that hope out. And they started looking at their government, their people in a different way, which happens. Which, of course, begs you the question of why did the U.S. do what it did? Because it was the U.S. that hit it. They double-struck the school right off the bat, first day. On the videos, you see children. Okay, you could somehow write it off on the first strike as a mistake. They double-tapped it an hour later. They've got the videos, you know, that these are children, this is a school. And they did it again. So it is intent, absolute intent.
You know, the only quote-unquote benign interpretation that I have about this is that if they seriously believe they were striking a military center, plus you then couple that with what you told me, the double tap directive is like, you know, you shoot at it again just to make sure. By anyhow, so an hour is not a lot of time to confirm what you did, especially from that distance, that they thought they were double tapping, which, by the way, in and of itself is a crime, but they were double tapping a military facility. That's the best and most benign interpretation I can give. On the other hand, you know, looking at how Israel implemented its wars and its genocides, right? It's clear that you try to go after these humanitarian targets in order to dehumanize and demoralize the other, and basically tell them, look, you're worth nothing, and we kill any and every one of you anyhow. So resistance is futile, you know, that kind of impression.
Yeah, well, it never works. Look, you know, on the Eastern Front, the Germans, okay, there were no official priests, obviously, so they went after, when they could, they went after the political officers, but it's hard to target a political officer. They don't look that much different. But they would go after the nurses. They'd go after anybody like that. Right now, you know, if whenever the Western forces in Ukraine, because I'm just going to call these Ukrainians, they'll go after the press right off the bat. The press no longer wears a press jacket. Yeah. They wear the same camouflage with just a small sign right here that says in blue press. The rest of it is the same camouflage. Because if you wore the blue press, that normally you're an automatic target. Just like you are with the Israelis. Israelis, that's what they look for. So on the Russian front there, that went away. On the Russian side, that went away a very long time ago. On the flip side, they also go after priests whenever they can. They go after priests, they go after medics, they go after any of these types of people. It doesn't work. It just pisses people off even more, but they still do it.
Extremely nasty. But, you know, the thing is, the people who implement this kind of stuff, you know, this is also the people who have been in these positions for a long time. And you see, you saw, for instance, how going on day number, what was it, 4 or 5 in Serbia after their after the radio station and the TV station. I mean, that worked. I mean, Yugoslavia was successfully broken up. The Chinese, they paid reparations for it. They paid reparations for it. They said they keep saying it was an accident. I don't know. And China at the time was not what China is today. I would believe a certain level of accidents, I believe. But still. The point is that you have these kind of tactics and techniques that have been used, of course, by the West for a long time. Yes, and again, they are even when they're not in the manuals, they're something that under the, off the record, people within the army teach to each other. Yes. So it becomes kind of institutional a habit to work like that. You know that you shouldn't do that because it's against the laws of war.
I was taught to double tap when I was a cadet.
You told me that, I'm shocked because in the U.S. Army.
Yeah. We had a Special Forces staff or a first sergeant who was our instructor for cadets. We were taught to double tap. Unless you need a prisoner to, unless you need in Russian it's called a tongue, yazyk. Somebody, you know, to interrogate, you double tapped. I was told by a professor who was in Vietnam that they used to regularly toss people out of helicopters to break. They would take. Did I ever tell you about that?
No, you didn't.
Oh, okay. So I was doing when I was in the military, I was doing a second degree on computer science, and there was a course on managing memory. How do you memory hole? How do you determine what if your memory's overloaded? How the system's supposed to look through which portions of memory to delete, to refill with the new information, and so on. So I go to the professor because I had some questions. And he's like, we start talking. And he looks at me, he's like, you're military. I'm like, so active duty, all that. He's like, yeah, I was in the military too. I was in Vietnam. He's like, he was going through officer basic to be an infantry lieutenant. They said they came in, they're like, we need staff staff sergeant's interest, staff sergeant in military intelligence. I figured, that's a more survivable thing than being a line infantry. So he went into military intelligence, a staff sergeant, and said, he told me a lot of stuff of what they did. I mean, some really crazy stuff that spray Agent Orange, fly a helicopter in, they'd all rush in. So this is Viet Cong territory. They'd land a Huey, they'd all rush in, put a netting around the tree, start shaking the trees to see how many leaves fall off, grab that, run back into the helicopter, fly out before the Viet Cong realizes they're there, shoots them down. But he said, if we had a guy that we wanted to break who knew a lot of information, we would take him, we'd take another guy that knows some, and we'd take two guys that know nothing. Lift the helicopter up at, 1,000 meters, come up to the first guy that knows nothing, just toss him out. Second guy that knows nothing starts babbling, trying to say something, he doesn't really know anything, so we toss him out. We get to the third guy who knows something, he tells us everything, we go, and we toss him out. And by that time, the fourth guy is mentally broken, and we take him down, and we go to interrogate him. So this is common practice.
Holy Jesus. One-off.
This was absolute common U.S. military intel practice. And as many people said, my lie happened almost every day. It just happened that my lie got captured on video.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's again, that's how you explain it, right? It's this level of like outrageous violence at that point when it happens has already been normalized. Otherwise it wouldn't happen. Right.
Exactly.
Otherwise it would be breach. It's not, this is the whole point of why military manuals are supposed to matter, because in those military manuals, you write down the rules of engagement that your own people are supposed to keep to. And you teach that to everybody down. And that's the gold standard. And if then you have basically a separate set of rules that are being just told orally to everybody to override that, well, then you set yourself up for systematic not just human rights abuses but humanitarian law abuses, and that should land you actually in a you know, in a war criminals court, but of course it doesn't, because as long as you're not caught and you don't lose your, you don't go. But that's the kind of thing that already worked itself out for decades in the Western Alliance, and that's why they didn't act with this kind of grotesque brute force while still claiming that no, our military manuals are the gold standard, best ever, and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, this double speak, it's very disgusting. But I think by now, actually, other parts of the world understood that that's the name of the game. And the interesting thing about the Iranians is that they still keep to their manuals, actually. They keep, anyhow. Yeah.
Well, you know what the punishment in the Red Army for rape was?
You told me, summary execution immediately.
Yeah, one of my grandfathers was a captain in the Armor Corps going into Berlin, and he summary executed a lieutenant for raping a German woman. Almost got shot himself before they figured out why he did it. Theft and pillage was punishment battalions.
I have a weird question. I just never understood why they call it summary execution. I mean, it's more like a conclusion. Why is it not a conclusive execution? I never understood that. Sorry.
The English language is a very interesting entity. Well,
okay.
How is Japan viewing all this? Because, you know, China played Trump down, but they weren't... I mean, you didn't see Xi showing up on the tarmac. In fact, he was meeting with the president of Tajikistan, and from what I've been told, half the flags hadn't been switched from U.S. flags, from Tajik flags to the U.S. flags as they were driving in. I mean, when Kim Jong-il or when Putin shows up, Vladimir shows up, Xi shows up at the tarmac, they go hand in hand, they drive in. Trump didn't get that kind of treatment. She was standing on the stairs, this controlling position where Trump had to come to him, shake his hand. There was a lot of control, you know, subtle control that was, the Chinese are very good at. They're putting you in your position without actually putting you in your position.
Yeah, there is. But then again, I mean, it's the same thing the other way around, right? When she met Biden, but in San Francisco, right? Mm-hmm. And there, I mean, he had to go, and it's Biden who stands and waits. I mean, this is still within the expected kind of protocol. So let me say that the Chinese didn't breach protocol in that sense. They just didn't extend all of the flowery thing they could have or would have if it had been a close friend and ally, let's say, like Vladimir Putin. The Japanese looked at that, of course. I think I haven't read anything negative about it. They reported on it, of course. They said, like, this is what happened, met here and there, and so on. Very matter of fact kind of thing. I guess they are happy that there was no blow up, because, again, the Japanese also have no interest in an escalation,
even though
there's some remilitarization going on and it is a right-wing government, but they do not have an interest in making a challenging economic environment now, especially with the oil price and with the oil flows and so on, making that even worse. They really don't want that. And even though Takaichi said some stupid stuff back in December about Taiwan, they do not really want to have a contingency in Taiwan. Again, a Taiwan contingency is also an Okinawa contingency, is also a whole of Japan contingency. They have every interest in not seeing that happening. So anything that goes toward a non-confrontative position is something welcome over here. The Japanese are just worried about the long-term developments, and I must say, I read a couple of think tanks over here. There's not that many, but a few of them, and a few of them published in English. And I was surprised the other day when I read a paper from January or so that was talking about, you know, the naval strategy and what we've learned. And some parts of the Japanese security bubble, and it is a bubble, you know, it's not a huge one, but it is. And they write for each other and reflect each other. And some of them are just very, very much caught in the, let me say, traditional kind of 1980s, 1990s, security think and security speak, including China threat, including freedom of navigation, including, like, you know, all of the jargon that has established itself. And within that, one that surprised me is that they wrote about the importance that Japan, Japan's ability to defend the first island chain. And I scratched my head and said, like, in what way is it, can it be part of Japan's national security to take over the responsibility from the United States to defend the first island chain? And defend the first island chain is, of course, a jargon for expressing the idea that you cut the Chinese Navy out of the Pacific. The first island chain ranges from like Hokkaido down over Taiwan down to the Philippines, right? That they get the blue water, right? Okay. So the first island chain refers to that. There's a second island chain with Guam and so on, but that was always like a fuzzy construct. But the first one, the idea is you have choke points, right? And if you can close them well enough, then the Chinese are basically, you know, incarcerated over there. It's a dumb idea as well, because these choke points are huge. Absolutely, not Strait of Hormuz kind of couple of kilometers. But it's people operate under these dumb ideas. And what surprised me is reading in one of these papers that Japan has to, you know, until now it was the United States that took the responsibility for the first island chain, and now it's going to be Japan that has to step up. It's like, that's just dumb. That's just dumb. I mean, that's just stupid. But the thing, the fact is that such policy papers circulate, and I don't think this is a paper that is in any way, shape, or form comparable with what comes out of, let's say, the RAND Corporation or Hudson Institute in the United States, or what's the big one? The other one that always puts out stuff. It's not on that level. It's just some within the security bubble here are still caught within the security thinking that was very much implanted by the US, and kind of identifying US strategic priorities with Japanese strategic priorities. There is a good number of others who actually are very much aware that that's what's best for Japan is not necessarily what's best for the United States, and they're trying to work on that or work it out.
Right.
It's hard to say who's where exactly, especially also within the political process, because the Japanese, much more than others, do make decisions by a committee, and you're not always sure who's sitting in the committee and who not. But they do. Kind of not everything is consensus based, but much more than in other places.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. Japan would have to what? How many ships are in the Japanese Navy or the Defense Force? I mean, it's not that small, but it's not that big.
No, on the Global Firepower Index, Japan is somewhere place 8 or 9, so not very strong, but not weak either. You know, the self-defense forces, as they're still called, are not a weak force, but they're anything but overpowering. So I don't know. The short answer is I don't know. They always try to maintain a capacity that is kind of adequate for the maritime environment they're in. But that's the point is they did a smart thing, which is on the one hand they have the maritime self-defense forces, but on the other hand they also have a relatively large coast guard.
Right.
And the good thing is, and this is one of the things that gives me hope, is that most of the stuff that's being done, especially in the islands and where, you know, where it gets kind of hot with the Chinese, is done actually by the Coast Guards. And Coast Guards are a police force. They're not a military force. So they're supposed to you know, keep up public order, and they have completely different manuals of engagement. You know, use water cannons and not real cannons, and so on and so forth. And the Chinese actually do a similar thing. So it's more it's less the actual military branches that are pitted against each other, especially where in these hotspots. It's more the coast guards, and well, that still can lead to problems down the road, but it's like a notch lower than how things are boiling or were boiling between, let's say, Iran and the US, and so on. I mean, it's not comparable in the terms of how they work with each or against each other. You know, the signaling is a different one.
Well, what about Japanese and Chinese relations, especially after Trump's a disruptive element in everybody's economies, obviously.
Yeah.
But,
I mean, the Japanese-Chinese relations are not good, especially since December.
Trade,
I haven't looked at the numbers recently. Mm-hmm. I mean, we haven't seen a huge shift. I mean, there's the Iran war impacted Japan much mm-hmm. more. Something that changed is less Chinese tourists. Although there's Japanese who are happy about that, and some Thai tourists happily step in and you know, benefit from the cheaper prices that they're getting here at the moment. But on the other hand, you know, the things that students, still a lot of students at my mm-hmm. university, a lot of Chinese students.
Oh, okay.
They didn't depart, and they're still coming. Mm-hmm. So also. The city of Kyoto, you know, there's quite a lot of Airbnbs owned mm-hmm. by Chinese. There's quite a significant number of houses. Mm-hmm. So the Japanese haven't changed those laws. I mean, Chinese and foreign nationals can still own property, and they do. And so that still is still up and running. And the rhetoric is kind of nasty. So on the institutional level, you know, some institutions did intervene. There was in the other university where I was teaching, Ritsumeikan, they had a deal with a Chinese university, mm-hmm. I forgot which one, that they would send students for programs, and they canceled those programs because of those. I mean, the Chinese side canceled it because of the comments that Takaichi made. So there are on the institutional level impacts, yes. Mm-hmm. I still think that the overall goal is to have an outcome. I mean, neither side, at from how I see it at the moment, has an interest in actually in somehow going to a war or to an outright confrontation. Even though some Chinese analysts have said things like that, and the Chinese threatened again, as I said in the beginning, if Japan ever so much as thinks of creating a nuclear weapon, then we'll go to war immediately. I mean, the rhetoric is very belligerent, but I still must say they do that, in my view, with the objective that Japan wouldn't go there and get the message that to have peace, please recognize that we feel very, very bad about what happened, what you did to us 80 years ago. And the Japanese, unfortunately, still don't have that. I think we talked about that before. They don't have that mentality, unfortunately.
We all suffered. Some suffered more than others, but for other reasons.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, you know. On the other hand, the pacifism here is not gone. We've had relatively large demonstrations a couple of weeks ago, 2-3 weeks ago, in downtown Tokyo. 50,000 people opposing Takaichi, saying like, "No war, we want peace. Stop this." And mm-hmm. you know, the Japanese are not easy to mobilize. They don't often do public rallies. 50,000 isn't huge, but for Japanese, apolitical. Japanese is quite apolitical when it comes to that. It is relatively large for what Japanese society usually does. So it's not. The country is nowhere near where Europe is at the moment. You know what the Europeans are preparing to do with Russia is like a decade away if ever, like with Japan and China. I mean, they don't perceive each other in those terms.
Yeah, and Germany had Operation Deutschland, which they're discussing a building right now, quote defensive, and they started discussing mass internment of Russian POWs. Which doesn't happen in defensive warfare. You get some, but you don't get mass. Mass is when you're on an offensive and you're trying to surround an enemy and take them out. But from the Japanese, so the U.S. has stripped out Patriot systems for Iran, obviously enough. And I don't know if they did it in the middle of the night in Japan, like the way they did it in South Korea, where they quite literally in the middle of the night were moving their units out. I still got caught by local media. So how's that resonating in Japan?
I still need to talk to my colleagues, the Japanese colleagues in the security circles here, but I'm pretty sure that this drove home the point of one of the two factions, which has been saying we need more indigenous capacity to do that, mm-hmm. to make those things. Because like the funny thing that this also shows is like, you know, this kind of mask off moment. Every time the United States says, "We're selling Patriot systems," and the Japanese go, "We bought Patriot systems." Did you ever buy a car where the guy who sold it to you can just come at night and take it back whenever he needs it somewhere else? They don't. This is not the nature of these contracts. Is not one of selling and buying. It's one of provision, right? One provides the weapons. The other one provides some
the manpower.
Cash in return. So it's kind of, and I think the No, not I think. I mean, I know that the Japanese for a long time, they believed very much because they themselves, they believe in the written word, right? If you make a written promise, if you write something down also in your constitution, you've got to keep that. And they actually do. They actually believe in the written word. And I know that, you know, I mean, how they believed in the neutrality pact in the Second World War. I mean, they clung to it. Also with the constitution, during Corona, you know, the constitution forbids the government from overstepping certain, doing certain things. In most Western states, they did it anyhow. In Japan, they didn't. There was never a mask mandate. The police could never punish you for not wearing a mask, and they never did, because that's personal freedom according to the constitution. They never ever went there. They said everybody please, and then most people followed, but they never had a mandate. So anyhow, long story short, they believe in the written word, and for a very long time they actually believed, since they have this security treaty with that goes back to 1960 with the Americans, that does this grand bargain, right? It's basis for security,
right,
and they put a lot of belief in that, and that's why it was a big deal back when, I think it was in 2016 or 15, when Obama actually said, you know, the Senkaku Islands, they're covered by that treaty, that the Japanese all went like collectively, they're part. I mean, they're safe because the Americans just said that they would do it. Therefore, it's real, right? And first Trump administration brought home the point that maybe that's not that reliable anymore, and the second one for sure is not driving home the point. There's still a good part of the population here that believes that, you know, all you need is a promise, but the other part is now understanding that no, we can't trust this. That's why they are also in a struggle internally to figure out a new security strategy going forward that does two things at the same time. Gives more indigenous capacities, proper capacities, not the kind of I'm gonna take my car back in capacity or non-capacity. And on the other hand, they do not want to upset the status quo. Again, they do not want to give up this relationship with the United States, because it has worked for 80 years, or 70 years. Why would you? And it's still baked in also institutionally, the way that the self-defense forces work with the United States, the integration and so on. So it's kind of, I would say Japan is between a rock and a hard place, also in the way that they need to figure out again how to organize this. And I cannot tell you which faction is how strong at the moment and which direction they're going. The only thing I can say is from the way that, you know, the ones who want more integration with the United States and who want to maintain this, and the ones who want more indigenous capacities, the one thing they converge on is that they need to have more things, right? So that's why the militarism or the militarization that we're seeing is driven by different emotions or interpretations of what's going on. But that one will probably continue, because the Japanese currently feel quite insecure and vulnerable, and that pushes them right now to more defense spending, which is popular in the US, of course, because it means more contracts. But I do hope they understand that if you spend it, then at least also figure out how to make it. Not that that's a good thing. I also don't like that. But again, I mean, Patriot Systems, I don't know where they... But this is the general discussion at the moment. That's how they are moving.
You know, there's a trend in a lot of society toward you bought it, but you don't really own it. The latest trend in the automobiles in the West seems to be you buy the automobile and then you pay for a subscription, monthly subscription, to use your radio, to use your air conditioner, to use all these other platforms. You know, that's and Porsche, which is an amazing move. Amazingly stupid move. Porsche. About 2 or 3 months ago, they bricked all their cars in Russia, all their more modern cars in Russia. They switched all the computers, which every Russian dealer has a bunch of hackers. They'll just reset the system. But the fact is, once you've done that, what's the message to everybody in Japan or Indonesia or in China? You piss off the Germans and we'll just brick your cars.
But
why would I buy a German car then?
No, you shouldn't. I mean... Also, I wonder how long it will take the Swiss, for instance. They bought these, they've been paying now for Patriot systems that haven't been delivered for years.
And they told them they're not coming anytime soon.
And they've been paying for F-35s that are not coming. And they even said, like, even if they're coming, like, you know, the keys remain with us. If we don't turn them around, then your little airplane's not going to fly, and you're still going to pay us a lot of money for that. And they still do that. But, you know, again, it's worse.
It's worse. I had a Colonel Wilkerson and I, we do an interview every couple of weeks, and he was telling me early on, the contract, and this is mind-boggling, the contract with, it's not Raytheon, it's who's doing the God, can I remember it? The company that's producing the F-35. It's
it doesn't matter. Yeah, that company.
Right. It doesn't matter. I'll look it up. But the contract said in the contract there are subsystems like avionics and propulsion that the military is not allowed to repair on its own. It has to be the representative, the mechanics from the company that are paying $400 or $500 an hour for. Or maybe more. It's a military contract, and that's the contract. So it, on an aircraft carrier, you have civilian teams sitting there getting paid incredible amounts of money because you know if you have F-35, somebody has to work on avionics and other portions. And by contract, the U.S. military is not allowed to do that. Well, I guess no military is allowed to do that by those contracts.
No, it's a racket. It's insane. It's also what's ruining actually the entire Western alliance. The fact that it's not need based anymore. It's all about how to milk the cow even more.
Absolutely.
Even already dead on the ground. And it's so that's why the whole system. I mean, I think the West is really close to a point, probably even worse than where the Soviet Union was in terms of how these different like gears do not interlock anymore and do not produce the output anymore that it used to in the past. And you cannot change the goddamn thing because the machine is still running, right? So it needs to come to a standstill at some point. Lockheed Martin, thank you.
Lockheed Martin. And they're talking about this contract for each one of them and a lifetime could be like $500 million or more. For the lifetime, which nobody counts the lifetime. That's, by the way, if you ever done supply chain, that's something you notice in most companies. They only look at, they look at the minimum they look at per unit cost and maximum they look at per unit cost plus logistics. Nobody looks at lifetime expense. You know, what do I have to do to fix this, keep it running? How long can it run in when the cost of keeping it running outpaces the cost of replacing something? Nobody looks at that. But nobody's ever had this, you know, I can't fix it myself. I have to get it to the deal. It's not just under warranty. It's forever. You can't do anything yourself on it.
Any country with a little bit of strategic mindset and an understanding of what's happening is would now conclude that these kind of contracts, the best thing you can do with them is burn them somewhere. And then, I mean, the whole battlefield looks completely different anyhow. I think, I mean, the drone technology. I mean, if you have a little bit of brain, you invest a lot into drone technology and you invest a lot into figuring out how these little autonomous systems then are going to impact the future. Not anymore F-35s, just like aircraft carriers. They're still scary machines, but they're just not going to play that much of a role anymore. Oh, so no. I wonder how long it will take the apparatus in the United States, in Europe, and also in Japan to kind of catch up with that and change the security calculation. But at the moment, it's still, I mean, path dependence, right? You're still you're in that tanker and it's still headed in the way it's headed in. And it's hard to kind of steer it around.
Absolutely. Pascal, I know you're out of time. You told me that you've got another engagement. I want to thank you for joining the call. Everybody, thank you for coming on. Neutrality studies. I don't even have to ask Pascal where to find them. Neutrality studies. If you haven't signed up, what are you waiting for? And make sure you sign up. If you haven't signed up on mine, make sure you've signed up on mine. But then
sign up everywhere. You find a subscription button, you click it. Not for Lockheed Martin, but the rest you do.
Yeah. Oh, Lockheed Martin would love you to. I'm sure they have a channel of their own, you know. How to do great contracts.
How to lock in somebody forever? Oh my God!
Tell me there isn't a mass corruption to get that kind of contract through. I mean, how many palms you have to grease to get that kind of self-defeating contract through?
one of the greatest political scientists of the U.S. once told me, Peter Katzenstein, he told me, Pascal, don't call it corruption. That's the term we use when we want to allude that it's illegal. Like, use money politics, because it plays everywhere from the top to the bottom. It's money politics, and the most skillful systems, it's all legal. Lobbying, all legal.
I know.
Going out of office and then getting contracts, $2 million for a speech, it's all legal. Only in stupid systems, you know, you do it under the table and you can actually get arrested for it. The smart ones, they make sure that it's legal, and then that's it. Money politics.
I had a poli-sci professor. I was a sophomore. I had a poli-sci professor explain that to me, that lobbyism, you know, how it's buying the time of the person to hear your issues. Like, that's corruption. No, it's not corruption. You don't understand. You're 19. You don't understand. That's not corruption.
You understand perfectly. That's exactly what it is. It's like there's illegal corruption and then there's legal corruption. That's why, like, all of it on the one hat, it's just money politics. And that's how the goddamn system works. So
we'll leave it with money politics because it sounds good.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Stas.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you.